I hope you had a wonderful Sukkot. Well, we actually, I think our last session was before Yom Kippur, so I'll say it for Yom Kippur, and actually Rosh Hashanah also, right? It was right before Rosh Hashanah that we had the last one. It was before Rosh Hashanah at any rate. So, all that means that we have to do some reviewing in order to remember what in the world we're talking about. Because otherwise, it might as well be Kohelet as Shir HaShirim. So let's see if we can launch right into a quick review of where we've been, and then start on what I hope to accomplish this week as well as next week. So, in the two sessions that we had before the Chagim, and let me just remind you actually, the transcript is running. If you don't want to see the transcript, there are options, especially if you're using a computer as opposed to an iPad. I do it on the iPad. But there are options for getting rid of it on your computer under More, Hide Transcript or something along those lines. On the other hand, if you find it entertaining or useful, then keep it. So in the two sessions that we had before Rosh Hashanah, we covered the following issues. Is there one author for Shir HaShirim, or are these poems written by multiple authors? What leads our sages who say Shlomo wrote it? Evidence from within the text, evidence in general, and why does that matter to us? I'm not answering these. These are just the questions that we addressed. What are the challenges to the view that Shlomo wrote it? How did the sages deal with the graphic language of Shir HaShirim, in including it in Tanakh? And there I'll take a second, because I wanted to add a source. We said that, number one, they saw the text itself as having overwhelming value. Just as in Yechezkel, we find also at one point some graphic language in criticizing pursuit of idolatry, so too here they find value in this language, and therefore they are okay including it in Tanakh. We also noted that they de-eroticized it by emphasizing that it's not meant to be translated literally, and we saw a few different elements within that. And then I wanted to note something that I only saw this week. I wasn't familiar with this before. If you take a look on your sheet, the first note on the sheet, where it says, added note, Bishop Oregon. So Bishop Oregon is from the end, he was born in the end of the second century Common Era, and obviously, yeah, an important figure in the early church. He writes a commentary on Shir HaShirim, and I'm going to reference it later, in terms of a key element of how we approach Shir HaShirim. But here, I wanted to show you a piece from his introduction, his prologue. He says, for this reason, and in the edition that I have, which is the online edition that's linked there, I gave you the link in source number one, it's missing what came before this. So I don't know what he means when he says, for this reason. But he says, for this reason, therefore, I advise and counsel everyone who is not yet rid of the vexations of flesh and blood, and has not ceased to feel the passion of his bodily nature, to refrain completely from reading this little book and the things that will be said about it. He says, don't read Shir HaShirim if you are still vulnerable to human passions. It's not good for you. And then he says, for they say that with the Hebrews also, care is taken to allow no one even to hold this book in his hands who has not reached a full and ripe age. I don't know what full and ripe age means. Presumably it means 1 year older than I am now. But he says, unless you've reached a full and ripe age. And there is another practice too that we have received from them, namely that all the scriptures should be delivered to boys by teachers and wise men, while at the same time the four special texts that they call Deuterosius, which isn't the word that we know, but has something to do with Mishnah Torah, clearly. Nonetheless, these four texts, the beginning of Genesis, in which the creation of the world is described, the first chapters of Ezekiel, which tell about the Kruvim, the end of Ezekiel, which contains the building of the temple, and this book about the Song of Songs, should be reserved for study till the last. Those are the last things you should study in Tanakh. So I find all of this very, very interesting, as he presents his view of how Jews approach Shir HaShirim. Some of it is consistent with what we know about how we treat Kabbalah, right? The idea that it's not supposed to be studied until you are a certain age and that you're supposed to receive it from a mentor is something seen in the Mishnah in the second chapter of Chagiga. Not regarding Shir HaShirim, regarding you know, apparently mystical and deep philosophical topics. But he says he understands that Jews do this with Shir HaShirim as well. There's kind of restriction of its study, and in particular, the concern for the passions that are aroused by it. So, you know, add that to your list of how this dealt with, you know, the study of Shir HaShirim. I'm treating it as though his account of this is authentic, that's what Jews were doing. I don't see a real reason to assume he made it up. I don't see an agenda that he would be serving. And like I said, this is something we know that Jews did for other texts. So I don't know. But that's on that front in terms of the graphic language of Shir HaShirim. We also dealt with the question of how the sages dealt with the absence of overt religious content in the book. And we said that they saw the book as having a religious message, and they made every effort to show it from within the text. We will, though, see an approach which reads the surface layer as significant in its own right, something that we don't find in traditional readings, but it's something that we're going to come back to before we're done with Shir HaShirim. We then concluded those 2 weeks by showing basic outlines of the text itself, the multiple poems, the multiple voices of the speakers, and when we get to the layers of commentary on Shir HaShirim, we're going to see more about the different poems that make up the book and their messages, the question of who the different voices in the Megillah represent. What I want to do today, and I want to do next week, is to look at Medrash on Shir HaShirim. Medrash really deserves pride of place because it's the original. When you talk about how the sages first read Shir HaShirim, you're looking at Medrash first and foremost. All the commentators we have are all later. So we need to look at how they read it, but they largely ignore the question of who the voices in Shir HaShirim are. They ignore the questions of what are the messages of the different poems and how do they interact. That is not what interests Medrash. What does interest it is where we're going to go. That's what we're going to talk about. Last note of introduction on this. I didn't put it on the sheet, but I put it in the email when I sent out the source sheet. I put the link for YU Torah where you can get all the recordings from previous classes in this series. It's now a collection on the website, and therefore there's just one link, and it'll take you to all the recordings from all the classes. So if you want to catch anything from previous weeks, just click on that, and you'll get all the links that you need. Okay, so what we're going to do this week and next week is look at Medrash. After that, I want to go into Rashi's school, the school of commentary that says that we should read Shir HaShirim as a love song between God and the Jews, followed by Rambam's school. It's not only his, but he's the best known, who says that Shir HaShirim is not about the Jews as a nation and God, it's about the individual and God. The individual looking for God and having difficulty in that search and so on. Then I'm going to want to move into some modern readings and elements that have been added in more recent generations before concluding with Professor Assis, who I referenced in our earlier discussions, and lessons from the love story itself. So when I say Medrash on Shir HaShirim, what I'm referring to is a body of Midrash called Shir HaShirim Rabbah. In the same way that we have Bereishis Rabbah, Shmos Rabbah, Vayikra Rabbah, this is Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Rabbah means great. It's the great Shir HaShirim. This is a very old body of Medrash. We know that different bodies of Medrash were collected at different times. it's not that in one generation, sages sat down and said, let's record all the midrashim that we have. It doesn't work that way. Even all of the Rabbah midrashim, so to speak, even all of the Chumash Rabbah midrashim, Bereishis, Shmos, Vayikra, Bemidbar, Dvarim, are not done at the same time. Some of the earliest midrashim to be collected are Bereishis Rabbah, on the book of Bereishis, Vayikra Rabbah, not Shmos Rabbah, interestingly, Koheleth Rabbah on Ecclesiastes, and a medrash called Psikta Derav Kahana. These are some of the first midrashim to be collected. They are collected somewhere in the period of 5th to 7th centuries. That's what we're talking about here. The midrashim themselves are much older, but this is when they're collected, canonized, put into a single text. I see the note in the chat asking, what is the difference between midrash and medrash, or medrash and midrash? And the answer is pronunciation. That's the difference between them. Technically, midrash is the more accurate way to say it, but Jews will continue to say medrash as long as there are Jews. So we have both. Shir HaShirim Rabbah could be considered sort of the next generation of Midrashim. It is influenced by all of the ones I just mentioned. It draws on material from each of them. We find material taken from each of them that makes it into Shir HaShirim Rabbah. It also draws on the Jerusalem Talmud, Talmud Yerushalmi. Shir HaShirim Rabbah is compiled in Israel. You can tell that based on its sources as well as based on its language, meaning the style of writing and the type of Aramaic that you see in it. There's Hebrew also, but the type of Aramaic that you see in it is much more an Israeli Aramaic. It's generally dated as having been compiled in the 7th to 8th century. So you're talking about the 600s into maybe the early 700s. Although, again, the Midrashim themselves are much older. And here I gave you a link on the sheet in source number 2. This was a godsend. When I was learning Shir HaShirim Rabbah and trying to prepare this, I came across a phrase in it that I did not understand why. I didn't understand what in the world it was doing there. It just didn't seem to fit at all. And so I Googled it because, you know, what else are you going to do? And I found a doctoral thesis from Dr. Tamar Kadari called, as you see here in source number 2, Limlechet Ha'aricha B'Midrash Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Essentially, as you see in the link, the redaction of Shir HaShirim Rabbah, the editing work of Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Her doctorate is on who edited, put together Shir HaShirim Rabbah and what their motivations were. She dealt with that passage that I thought just didn't belong and explained that and a whole lot more. Her doctorate is about 400 pages, a little more than that. So it's not light reading, it's in Hebrew. But if you want to know more on the academic side, you know, she's great. She brings in a lot of others who wrote before she did. She did this doctoral thesis, I think, about 15, 20 years ago. So, you know, it's relatively recent. And she references a lot of her predecessors. And I found it to be really good work. So this was a big boost, and we're going to use it in learning this. So I want to start our actual look. Actually, before I start, questions and comments on what I've said so far, because I threw a lot at you here. No, we're good? Okay, then let's go further. So I want to start with a quote from Shir HaShirim Rabbah, which highlights for me why this is such an interesting way to look at Shir HaShirim. Take a look at source number 3. Ad Shehamelech v'Mesibo. This is a piece of a passage that's in the first chapter of Shir HaShirim. Okay? Ad Shehamelech v'Mesibo. While the king is yet reclining, right? Heseba, like Mesubin at the Seder. Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda had a machlokes. They had a debate. Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir Omer, Ad shamelech malchei amlachem HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'mesivo barakia, nasnu Yisrael reyach ra. The rest of this sentence, or more of this sentence, Jirashirim, it goes, Ad shamelech b'mesivo nir di nasan reycho. My nerd, which I think is usually translated as spikenard, it's some kind of an herb with a strong scent. My spikenard gave forth its scent. So the Medrash has Rabbi Meir say, while God was yet reclining in the heavens, the Jews gave forth a bad scent. The Amru Le'egel saying to the calf, Eile Elokecha or Elohecha Yisrael, this is your God, Israel. So, according to Rabbi Meir, this line in Shir HaShirim is saying, while the king was reclining, we sinned. We brought the golden calf. Rabbi Yehuda responds to Rabbi Meir, and he says, absolutely not. Amar le Rabbi Yehuda, dayach Meir. Rabbi Yehuda says, enough with you, Meir. He can get away with saying that because he's Rabbi Yehuda. I wouldn't advise for any of you to try first name basis. Rabbi Yehuda says, enough of you, Meir. Ain't dorshin shir hashirim lignai ela l'shevach. He says, you are not allowed to interpret a line in shir hashirim in a derogatory way. There is nothing in Shir HaShirim that will be a criticism of the Jewish people. Shalamitan Shir HaShirim el Shivchan Shal Yisrael. The point of Shir HaShirim is to praise the Jewish people. Then what did that line mean about the smell? Umau ad shamelech b'mesibo. What's that line about the king and his reclining and all that? Ad she'amelech malchei amlachem HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'misibo barakia, when Hashem was reclining in the heavens, nasnu Yisrael reyach tov lifnei Har Sinai. The Jews gave forth a good scent, accepting the Torah at Har Sinai. Now, what the meaning is of Hashem reclining is a good question, but not for right now. The point isn't that. The point that I bring this for is this debate that you see among the sages of how do I read Shir HaShirim? Is this meant to be a no warts version, a sanitized version of the relationship between Hashem and the Jews, Rabbi Yehuda's position? Or is it meant to be more realistic, like Rabbi Meir? And Rabbi Yehuda says, absolutely, this is meant to be a cleaned up version of the relationship between Hashem and the Jews. Everybody is happy in Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim is a happy place. You want something sad? Go read Koheles. Go read Eicha if you like. But no Eichas in Shir HaShirim. Similarly, if you take a look at source number 4, another Medrash, Heviani El Beis Hayayin, from the second chapter in Shir HaShirim, he brought me to the house of wine, and the rest of the sentence is Vidiglo alai ahava. His degel, which we'll read as flag for now, his flag upon me is of love. What does that mean? Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, once again, have a debate. Rabbi Meir Omer, Amra Knesset Yisrael, the Jews said, Hushlat bi yetzer hara ki yayin. The Yetzer Hara, inclination towards evil, if you want to translate Yetzer Hara, was given control over me like wine. Ve'amarti la'egel, such that I said to the calf, Eile Elokecha Yisrael, this is your God Israel. I sinned because I was brought into the house of wine. Hadein Chamra, wine, kar'olo bebarnash, when it enters a person, Hava ma'arvavle, it confuses him. So the wine confused me, it addled my brain. Amalo Rabbi Yehuda, to which Rabbi Yehuda responds again, Dayoch Meir, enough for you, Meir. Ein dorshin shir hashirim lignai ela l'shevach. You can only interpret shir hashirim as a positive. Shalanitan shir hashirim ela l'shivchan shal Yisrael. Shir hashirim is meant to be the praise of the Jewish people. Umau heviyani al beis hayayin. So what is the meaning of he brought me into his house of wine? Amra Knesset Yisrael. The Jews said, Hevi Ani HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Martev Gadol Shel Yayin. God brought the Jews to the great wine cellar, Ze Sinai. That's a reference to Sinai. V'nasan Lisham Digli, and he gave me my degel, right? Diglo alaya hava. He gave me the degel. What is that a reference to? Torah, mitzvos, ma'asim tovim. Torah, good deeds, that's what it is. Uba'ava gedola kibalti yosam, and I accepted them with great love. So, the conclusion in the Medrash, which is borne out by the entire canon, and it's a large body of Medrash, is with Rabbi Yehuda. You will never see anything in Shir HaShirim Rabbah that reads Shir HaShirim as a criticism of the Jewish people. So that's going to be really, really important in our understanding of this layer of how we read the text. So we're going to have to come back to and spend time on why that's so important. The Torah has no problem criticizing us. There is no Jew in Tanakh. There is no generation in Tanakh that escapes criticism. So why does this matter so much that Shir HaShirim Rabbah is not willing to see something negative in Shir HaShirim? Why is this such a big deal? I'll ask you, why is this such a big deal? Why can't it have a negative? I don't know. No, it's strange. I mean, it's unusual for us in our learning to find something that should be, you know, all positive. You know, it almost makes me feel uncomfortable. Like, is this Torah if it doesn't make me feel bad? That's strange. So this is something that we need to understand. And God willing, by the end of next week, we will understand exactly what's going on. Yes, Rose.
Maybe it's related to the fact that it's actually the relationship of Hashem and humanity. And that is what Hashem desires for it to be. And therefore we shouldn't impurify this positive spin on the relationship, be it with Israel or be it with the individual people. In other words, we shouldn't sully that relationship by thinking negatively.
So we're going to present such an unrealistic view? We're just going to pretend the golden calf never happened? You'll see.
No, but it's not about the calf, it's about the songs, right? It's about the songs that God is singing.
I mean, we did say there are poems here and the songs are being sung, but we're going to have to see more about this. I will answer one question here. Ricky, I see your hand. I'm coming back to you in 1 second. Thank you. I'm going to answer one question here, which I know people have to be wondering because I was wondering. I kept reading through the doctorate hoping that I would get an answer. Which is, so who actually is the compiler of Shir HaShirim Rabbah? Like, put a name on that. And the answer is, we're going to learn a lot about this person. We're going to learn a lot about the person's goals, but we do not know a name. We don't know who canonized Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Pretty sure it wasn't Bishop Oregon, but beyond that, I can't really tell you. Yes, Ricky. You're muted.
Maybe if we're uncomfortable as you are, maybe this gives us pause to do our own self-judgment and come to our own correction rather than coming from outside, which would be much more meaningful than somebody else criticizing us.
But this is us criticizing us. Shir HaShirim Rabbah is ours. It would be us criticizing us. Or do you mean each individual criticizing themselves?
No, you were saying earlier that it's strange that Shir HaShirim has no criticism and it's all very positive.
Right, so, well, now let me make sure I state it clearly because I should make this point very clearly. I'm not talking now about what Shir HaShirim says. I'm talking about the way Shir HaShirim Rabbah reads Shir HaShirim.
Well, it could be the same thing. The compilers said, okay, well, this is all very positive, but think for yourself, are you free of guilt? and self and criticism.
It's just, maybe it's such an unusual thing. It's such an unusual thing to read a rabbinic text explaining something from Tanakh with, and saying, there's nothing negative here, there's no criticism here, there's no, I mean, it's just, you know, I've quoted in other classes, Rashi on Divrei Hayamim is not really Rashi, it's somebody else. And last year on the Tuesday afternoon class when we did Malachim, I actually showed you examples that demonstrate that. But there is a comment that is in this pseudo Rashi on Divrei Hayamim, where he goes through all of the kings of Judah. And for each one, he shows that Tanakh identifies a flaw, something about them that wasn't right. And he says, all but one, Yotam is the only one who's not. And when you look at Yotam and Divrei Hayamim, you actually find something to criticize in Yotam also. Yotam did not escape either. Everybody gets criticized in Tanakh. That's just the way it is. Everybody's got a flaw. We're human.
Yeah, but see what I'm saying about giving us the opportunity to do our own criticism.
I don't know. I hear what you're saying, but I'm not feeling it. Yes, Janine.
That's the strength of the Jewish people.
That what?
As everybody's criticized, we don't hold anybody up as perfect.
Yeah, but apparently in Shir HaShirim, according to Shir HaShirim Rabbah, we're suddenly perfect. Right? You could be crass, I suppose, and just say, it's like the, airbrushing the photos of the wedding, you know, and just say like, okay, but you need an opportunity to be airbrushed. Like, let it be in Shir HaShirim. And maybe that's the answer. I don't know. Janine and then Dahlia.
I think it's an idealized love story, even though it's imperfect because there's a constant not meeting of the two. But I think it's looked at and interpreted as an idealized love story. And then you don't start talking badly about the person.
Right. So I would have said that's actually like shot in the story. The story is such a positive. Except that that's not the way it plays out. Right? The classic, kol dodi do fake, right? My beloved is knocking at the door and I can't get out of bed because I already took, that's made for criticism. It seems like a criticism. And Shir HaShirim Rabbah says, no, there's no criticism to see here. Everything's fine. We're all good. That's my problem, is that I don't think it's consistent with the text broadly in Tanakh or in Shir HaShirim. Dahlia.
I'm wondering, was Bereishit Rabbah composed in Europe, under Christianity? Is there a reason because of the Christian scholars that they wanted to portray the story, which has so much eroticism, as a kind of completely idealized version, to satisfy the other critics? I mean, clearly this bishop had a conversation with some rabbi who told him, oh, don't worry about it. We understand that there is this element in it and we don't teach it to our kids. Because, the Christians have such hang-ups about this.
And, interesting.
The original sin and all of this. I mean, this would not appeal to their religious sensibility at all.
So
it almost seems like this was a cover-up for the sake of the Christians.
So I do think that there are Christians involved in this. We're going to talk about it. But not quite the way you're doing it, because the way you're doing it, I would look at it and say, this is not even the first book I would do this with then. Like, there's a long list of books in Tanakh I would have to start doing that with. But there is, I believe, a Christian element to this, which we're going to have to come back to. I think you're on to something there. Let's talk about Medrash. Bodies of Medrash, and an overview, sort of relevant points about them. We're not going to discuss here techniques of Medrash. If you want to know more about that, if you go to YU Torah and look at the links for my Medrash Shiur when we did the Medrash on Parshas Noach. Hey, this week is Noach. So we spent a year with the Midrashim on Parshas Noach in the Tuesday afternoon class. I gave another series at a different time on the Akedah. So there we talked a lot about the methods of Medrash. That's not what we're going to do here. But it's important to note that Medrash cares about messages. Pshat looks at a text with blinders. Pshat, right? Literally, people translate Pshat as the simple read. Pshat doesn't care about nuances of spelling or word choice or messages. Pshat just says, give me a simple read. It is worth noting, I always bring this when I discuss Pshat versus Medrash, the Gemara in source number 5, in which Hillel points out that Pshat requires a Mesorah as well. There are people who say, sort of, Medrash requires a rabbinic tradition to explain things, whereas Pshat is just what the text says. So that's nonsense. Pshat requires a rabbinic tradition as well. And that's the Gemara in Shabbos that I gave you in source number 5, the story about the fellow who comes to Hillel, first comes to Shammai, which was a mistake. Then he goes to Hillel. And he says to him, I just want to learn the written Torah. I don't want any of these rabbi rabbinic teachings. So Hillel says, sure. And he sits down with him and he draws on the board the characters, the first characters of the Hebrew alphabet. Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet. And he says, that's an Aleph, that's a Beis, that's a Gimel, that's a Dalet. He drills him in it, right? And then tells him to come back the next day. And the next day, the fellow comes back. And again, he shows him those characters, but he says, that's a Tuf, that's a Shin, that's a Resh, that's a Kuf. And the guy says, what are you talking about? It's an Aleph, Beis, no, it's a Tuf, Shin, Resh, Kuf. He says, yesterday you told me this, now you're telling me this. So he says, oh, so you need to rely on my tradition to tell you what the letters of the alphabet are. You don't think you also need to rely on my tradition to explain what the words mean? A dictionary also is a tradition. Everything is. So you can't kid yourself by saying, I'm just going to read Pshat and that's it. But the readings of Medrash are complicated. Medrash asks about language. Why is the text written the way it is, with those words and those spellings? It wants to know about meaning and messages. What am I supposed to learn from this text? And the result is that you have Medrash, which is called Medrash Halacha, which learns law in connection with verses, as well as Medrash Agada, which explains stories. You have Midrashim that explain specific textual anomalies. You have Midrashim which introduce specific concepts. But fundamentally, especially as we're going to see here, Medrash cares about messages. What is this text trying to teach me? Number two, Medrash feels free to separate a text from its context. Meaning, when you read a text and just do a pshat read, you assume sentence B follows from sentence A and leads into sentence C, right? Cause and effect. It's, you know, that's the way we read. However, Medrash doesn't always do that. Medrash will sometimes analyze a sentence as though it had no context at all. Sometimes it's very context-driven, but sometimes it acts as though there is no context at all. And we're going to see that a lot in Shir HaShirim. It'll just dive in, pull a clause, and explain it as though nothing came before it and nothing came after it. Third note, Midrashim are collected in works centuries after they are written with a particular goal or set of goals in the mind of the compiler. And here, I point to source number 6. This is from Dr. Kadari's work. She's talking about the goal of collecting Midrashim. What makes somebody decide to collect Midrashim and put them into a book? Remember that, and this is something that is really worthy of its own discussion, the idea of publishing a book at the time when they published Medrash was groundbreaking. You know, Mishnah, Gemara, the Talmud was originally verbal. And there was a wrenching decision to write it down for a range of reasons, dealing with persecution and forgetting and all these different explanations that tie together. But to decide not only are we going to do that, but we're also going to write down Midrashim was not simple and straightforward. The first halachic works, the first halachic texts after the Gemara don't show up until after Shir HaShirim Rabbah is already compiled. And Bereishis Rabbah, and Koheles Rabbah, and Vayikra Rabbah, these are all first, before that. And the question is, what makes you decide that this is an important thing to do? What makes you decide to invest the work in creating this compilation? There's a ton of work that goes into this. Kedari, I mean, I didn't bring this for you here because, like, we would never get anywhere if we spent time unpacking her 400 pages. But but it's an intense and massive task. Why would somebody do that? So in source number 6, I brought you, Dr. Kedari sums up 4 different approaches that are brought by scholars to explain why somebody would compile a body of Medrash. So I'm just going to read out my English translation in number 6, because we're eating up time very quickly here. In the research, she says, there are 4 central approaches to the question of the target audience for which the material found in Midrashic compilations was formed. There are 4 different approaches. The first approach thinks that the compilations were formed primarily of Midrashim stated before the broad community. Midrashim that were being collected in this were originally taught to the community at large. And the collection of these materials by a later compiler does not change the fact that the material presents oral lectures meant for a broad community of listeners. So the goal of compiling a Midrashic text is in order to take lessons that are popular and ensure that they will continue to be available for people. That's one approach. Second approach, in another view, the compilations were formed from debates of scholars and their teachers between the walls of the study hall, like Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, who we read before. The material is meant for a narrow elite of scholars. And at a later stage, it was collected and formed via principles which resemble the style of learning in the study hall. The second view is, it's an academic work. It's not meant to be a popular work. It's meant to be an academic work. These midrashim reflect academic study. Not when I say academic, it's the wrong word. Intellectual study by experts. And it's not meant to be for the masses at all. Third approach, she says, is that the compilations were formed as a professional literature for speakers and teachers. The midrashim are source books meant to help prepare lessons for the community or for students. It's meant as a resource for teachers. You know what it's like? Many years ago, I taught classes for the Melton program. So the Melton program distributes materials for the teachers, and then the teachers are supposed to take the materials and fashion them into a lesson, adding or not adding to whatever their interests and abilities are. So this is the source book. This body of Midrash that we're talking about is meant to be a source book for teachers. That's a third approach. A fourth approach is that the compilations of Midrash combined various materials, but they do not represent the sources from which they were combined. The Midrashim represent primarily the work of the compilers and their literary reasons and goals. There is a goal that is unique to the compiler that isn't what was originally intended when these Midrashim were composed, but the compiler wants to get to a central point and is using this in order to get to that point. And Kedari believes that this is what Shir HaShirim Rabbah is about. It's this fourth approach. Somebody did the work of compiling Shir HaShirim Rabbah in order to get to a particular message. You follow? Now, I don't want to bore you by going through all of her 400 pages and all of that, because fundamentally, a lot of it ends up being academic and not about Shir HaShirim itself. And I want us to learn Shir HaShirim. So what we're going to do is first survey some midrashim from Shir HaShirim Rabbah that give us insight into Shir HaShirim, and then come back to why all of this was compiled. Got it? You with me? Ricky.
possibly a selection that they may have left out because they have a goal. They may have left out things that
yes.
don't.
Yes, there are things that are omitted from Shir HaShirim Rabbah. One example you already know, right? Anything that, any interpretation of Shir HaShirim that is derogatory about the Jews doesn't appear. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist in Midrashim. Rabbi Meir tried really hard, right? The, you know, twice Rabbi Yehuda had to tell him go away. So there's stuff that is omitted. Kedari makes the point that almost any read of the text that is mystical, that explains Shir HaShirim in a mystical way, is not here. There's no interest in presenting that. Also, almost anything that reads it as a love story isn't here. There is some, but almost none, because that's not what they see as the message of the book. The compiler of Shir HaShirim Rabbah says, there's something I'm trying to get across, and I'm creating this in order to get that across. So you are correct.
The compilation of the mystical Midrashim?
Not that I know of. I'm far from an expert on Midrash. It could be it's out there. There are other Midrashim on Shir HaShirim besides Shir HaShirim Rabbah, but this is the original and the granddaddy. Yeah. Okay. I see your note in the chat, Jonathan. Thank you. So let's get into the sample of Midrashim, unless there was something further. Okay. So this sample of Midrashim will lead us to an understanding of how Shir HaShirim Rabbah reads Shir HaShirim and ultimately what its goal is. So first of all, and we've already seen some of this, there's a strong emphasis on how we are beloved to Hashem as a nation. We already saw the statement that Shir HaShirim has to be read as complementary to the Jews. There's a lot more that is like that here in the text. Now, starting with source number 7 and going through source number 12, I bring you a series of midrashim that we're going to go through from Shir HaShirim Rabbah. As Vanessa found, there is a published edition of Shir HaShirim Rabbah with English from Art Scroll, which may be useful for people who want to know more about Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Sefaria has on its site a translation that they call the Sefaria Medrash Rabbah edition, put together by a list of rabbis who are, you know, named on the site. And I have to admit, I just had too much stuff to translate this week. So as I wrote on your sheet, I borrowed from them, I adapted it, because they added some notes in that I felt took away rather than add. Corrected some things, but it's basically from them, and they deserve credit for that. If you go to sfaria.org, you can find it there. So, as an example of a medrash about the love of Hashem for the Jews, take a look at source number 7. The text in Shir HaShirim, the second verse in the book, really, in a sense, it's the beginning, because it's after the heading of Shir HaShirim, Asher L'Shlomo. Yishakeni minishikos pihu ki tovim dodecha miyayin. He shall kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. So the Medrash asks, Yishakeni minishikos pihu, heichon ne'emra. When was that said? What event is this referring to? Rabbi Chinan bar Papa Amar Bayam ne'emra. So Rabbi Chinan bar Papa says, at Yamsuf, at the Red Sea. How do I know that? Because a few sentences later, in Shir HaShirim, there's a comparison of the Jews to, or the beloved to, Lesusasi berechvei Faro, my horse in the chariots of Paro. What horse in the chariots of Paro would you be referring to? Well, at the sea. That's the comparison. A little bit of an odd comparison, because those horses didn't do well. Right? They ended up in the sea. But nonetheless, we are compared to the horse in the chariots of Paro. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Simon, Amar B'Sinai Namra, he says, no, it's talking about the Jews at Sinai. That's when we said that Hashem should kiss us with the kisses of his mouth. Where do you get that from? From the words Shir HaShirim, which he links with a verse from Tehillim. I'm going to skip the specific reference to the Shirim and the Sharim and jump to the next paragraph. Davar Acher, another approach. Yishakeni Minishikos Pihu. Again, he shall kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Amar Rav Yochanan, Malach Hayamotzi Hadibor Milifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says, this is referring to Har Sinai, and how, with every utterance that God produced, a malach took the utterance, what Hashem said, I'll call Dibor v'Dibor, umachziro, I'll call Echad v'Echad mi'Yisrael, and he brought it to every Jew. Ve'omar lo, and he said to the Jew, Mekabel al-Ata'alecha as Hadibor hazeh, do you accept this speech, what God just said at Sinai? Anochi Hashem Elokecha, or whatever it is. Did you accept that? Kach v'kach dinin yesh bo. It has these laws in it. Kach v'kach onchin yesh bo. It has these punishments in it. Kach v'kach gezeros yesh bo. It has these decrees in it. Kach v'kach mitzvos, v'kach kalim v'chamurin, and so on. All the different aspects of it. V'haya omer lo Yisrael hein. And the Jew would say yes. So it's the kisses of Hashem's mouth are his words that he spoke at Har Sinai. And we accepted them upon ourselves. And then along comes Rabbi Yonatan. Rabbi Yonatan also understands it as referring to Har Sinai. But he gives you a mashal. He compares it to something. Lemelech shemevakesh likach lo isha bas tovin ubas ginosim. You have a king who wants to marry a woman who comes from great leaders and wonderful people. Shalach etzla shaliach. So he sends a messenger to her. The Diberla, the messenger, speaks to her. Amra, and she said, Eini kidais l'shivchaso. She says, I am not worthy even to be his maid. Ela ritzoni l'shmo mipiv. But I want him to ask me directly. I'm not worthy of the following. Nonetheless, I don't want him to marry me via an agent. I want the king to propose to me himself. Kevin Shechazar Oso Ashaliach Ala Melech. So the agent comes back to the king. Hayupanav Sochakos V'sichosav Eina Nishmaos LaMelech. So yeah, on the one hand, he knows that he succeeded. The woman's interested. On the other hand, he's kind of stammering to the king because he doesn't know how to tell the king about the hubris of this request. I want to hear from the king directly. Hamelech Shepikeach Amar Zepanav Sochakos Doma Shekiblo Aleh. She says, well, this guy's smiling. It must be that she accepted. But, sichosav eina nishmosli, I'm not hearing his speech. Dome sha'amar ritzoni lishma mipiva, must be that she said, I want to hear it directly. The king figures out what it was that she said. Kach Yisrael hi bas tovim. We are the descendants of great people. Hashaliach ze Moshe. The agent of the king is Moshe. Hamelach ze HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem is the king. You follow? So Yishakeni Minishikos Pihu is the hubris of the Jews saying, we want Hashem's kiss directly. We're not interested in an intermediary. But it's still a positive. It's viewed as a function of love, and it inspires Hashem's love. One more medrash that talks about how beloved we are. One of the interesting things that Kadari points out about Shiashirim Rabbah is that in the beginning, it sets down principles of love between Hashem and us. At the end of the book, it turns the focus to talk about the Jew in exile and dealing with our suffering and our distance from Hashem. And this is an example of it. It's a beautiful example. So there's a verse towards the end of Shir HaShirim which goes, Hayosheves Baganim, the one who dwells in the gardens, Chaverim, friends, Makshivim Lekolech, listening to your voice, Hashmi'ini, let me hear your voice. The friends are listening, make your voice heard, you who sit in the garden. Okay, it's a call to the one who sits in the garden, please make your voice heard. What does that mean? Rabbi Nasan b'shem Rabbi Acha Omar. So Rabbi Nassan says in the name of Rabbi Acha, Lemelech Shekas al Avadav. Compare this to a king who was angry at his servants. V'chavshan bebeis kolin, and he threw them in jail. Ma asa hamelech. What did the king then do? Natal kol kitzarketin shelo v'avadav. He brought his officers and he brought his servants. V'halach lishmoa mahayu. Mahin omrin. He brought them, he brought all his people to stand by the jail and to hear what these imprisoned servants were saying. Shama shahayomrim, and he heard his imprisoned servants saying not, we cursed the king is terrible, the king did this to us, not that, just the opposite. Adonenu hamelech, hu shivchenu, hu chayenu, our master, the king, he is our praise, he is our life, Al nechsar l'adoneinu ha-melech le'olam. We never want to lose our king. So they're saying wonderful things. Amar lehem, and he turns to them and he says, Bonai, my children, hagbiu kolchem, raise your voices, kedei sheyishmu chaverim sha'al gabchem, so that your colleagues, my servants who are not in the jails, that let them hear what you are saying. You follow the parable? Again, the king throws some of his servants in jail for some wrongdoing. But when they're in jail, they only say positive things about him. They still love him. The king goes to hear what they're saying with his entourage. And he listens, and they're saying that they still love him. And the king says to them, raise your voices so my entourage will hear you. That's the idea. So, kach ava pisha Yisrael asukim v'malachtan kol sheshes yamim. He says the Jews are involved in their work all 6 days, and yet biyom Shabbos mashkimim u'boyim lebeis hakneses. On Shabbos they get up early and come to shul. V'korin kriyashma, they say shma ba'over in lifnei hateva. They lead the davening over lifnei hateva. They pass in front of the ark. Is a reference to leading the services. V'korin ba'torah, they read from the Torah. Maftirin benavi, they read the haftorah. V'HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer Lehem, and Hashem says to them, Banai, my children, Hagbiu Kolchem, raise your voices, Kidei Sheyishmu Chaverim Shal Gabchem, so that your friends over you will hear. Who are your friends? Who is the entourage? Vein Chaverim El HaMalachei HaSharis. It's a reference to the angels. And Hashem says, Utnu Da'atchem Shlo Tisneu Zeh Et Zeh. Make sure not to hate each other. V'lo tikne'u zeh, or tikanu zeh et zeh. Don't be jealous of each other. Lo techarcharu zem zeh. Don't fight with each other. Lo tevaishu zeh lazeh. Don't embarrass each other. Shelo yomru malachei asharis lefnei ribono shel olam, lest the angels say before God, Torah shenasata li Yisrael einan oskim ba. They're not involved in Torah. V'arei eva v'kina v'sin v'tachris b'neihem. They have all this fighting between them, this jealousy, this enmity, this competition. And you fulfill it in peace. And we then have a last line about how the malachim, the angels, have no competition between them. The point again being to emphasize how the Jews are beloved to Hashem. Clear? This is what Shir HaShirim is, like beginning, middle, end. Honestly, even though Kedari has a thesis that if you read Shir HaShirim in our editions, it's broken up into paragraphs and units. But in the original manuscripts, there's no breakup. It just goes straight through. And she actually believes that it was meant to be learned straight through with Shir HaShirim, like read it beginning to end. But I get tired of it after a while. It's just this unending positivity of Hashem loves us, it's all wonderful, we're great, we're loyal, and you know, after a while, it's a little much. Nonetheless, That's the take that you get here. Questions or comments before I go to the next medrash? Yeah, Janine.
I just found the end of 7, Rabbi Yochanan, interesting.
Yeah.
Because he says that God, that Israel said, we want to hear it directly from God. But what happened was exactly the opposite, that they said it's too much for us. We don't want to hear directly from God. So it's interesting
yes.
that he specifically brings that interpretation.
Yes. I agree. I didn't look into it, but you're right. It is a funny thing that it's acting as though we didn't want the shaliach when we actually did.
After shaliach.
Yeah, maybe I'll look into that and see what I can find. It is a good point. So, I'll give you just a quick note on one other medrash. If you look at number 9, it's a long medrash, but we're not going to read it out. I just want to show you what it does. Sometimes Shir HaShirim Rabbah uses structures in order to convey its message, so that in source number 9, a medrash which actually Kedari believes is the true beginning of Shir HaShirim Rabbah, you find great praise for Shlomo HaMelech, for King Solomon, couched in the number 3. The Medrash talks about sets of 3 that are associated with Shlomo. The original set of 3 that triggers it is the idea that he wrote Shir HaShirim Mishlei Koheles. But if you take a look at source number 9, you see, it begins by saying, Komasav shel oso ha'ish mishulashin hayu. All of Shlomo's deeds were 3s. How so? He went up in 3 levels. First, he's described, and we learned this last year in Malachim. First, he's described as ruling over the area by the Jordan. Then he is described as being a Moshel, more broadly a ruler over a broader area. And then he is described as sitting on the throne of God as king. On the other hand, he also descends 3 times. He's described as descending. On the one hand, he starts out as being a great king, but then he's described as being Melech Yisrael, king over just Israel, and then he's only, I was Melech Birushalayim, I was king in Jerusalem, and then finally he's just king over his house, when in Shir HaShirim it described the bed of Shlomo and him living in fear of attack. So Shlomo descends 3 steps. Hang on, Ricky, I want to make sure to get through this before we stop today. Then it talks about how Shlomo goes through 3 phases. He is a king, and then he is a commoner, and then he's a king, which is a whole story that we went through at the end of last year when we talked about Shlomo's descent that I don't want to go through right now because of time. You can see the Medrash and the translation here. He violates 3 laws regarding kings. He has too many horses. He marries too many wives. He assembles and amasses silver and gold. He has 3 opponents who God sets up for him in the very end of his story in chapter 11 in Malachim. He composes 3 different sets of proverbs which make it into the book of Mishlei. He says, Havel Havalim in Koheleth. We're going to have to come back to that. Havel is 1 Hevel. Havalim is 2 Hevels. 1 + 2 = 3. The Shir HaShirim, same idea. Shir, and then Shirim is 2 Shirs. So that's 3 Shirs. 3 Shirim. And he has 3 names, Yedidya, Shlomo, Koheles, all these sets of 3 that are meant to play up the greatness of Shlomo. Even though elsewhere we say that the references to Shlomo in the book are references to Hashem. Ricky, sorry to cut you off. Question.
I'm still stuck on the concept of hubris. In the Mashal, the woman is certainly showing hubris, but if we compare that to Har Sinai, I mean, that's not a positive thing. So I'm lost there.
What do you mean?
Positive?
What do you mean?
A little bit back when you were talking about relating the Mashal and the story of the woman.
Yeah.
And that is like us in front of Har Sinai, and we want to hear from Hashem.
Well, we didn't. That was Janine's point. We actually went the opposite route. We said we want Moshe to say it to us. So that's actually the problem with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what I want to do next time is to come back to the Midrashim. I want to see some very strange statements that we're going to find in the Midrashim. First, we're going to see source number 10, which is a little more straightforward. But then we're going to see some really strong and strange statements. And those are going to lead me to Dr. Kadari's thesis for what the goal of Shir HaShirim Rabbah is and what it's trying to tell us about Shir HaShirim. We probably won't need the entire time next time for this. So after that, we're going to start on what I consider the Rashi school, so to speak, of commentary to Shir HaShirim and see what it does within the text. So thank you very much and have a good week. Welcome back, everyone.
Thank you.
Be well.